Rundown from WUFT News, exploring our community from top to bottom. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Food stamps and other SNAP benefits are scarce this month because of the ongoing government shutdown, now the longest on record. This has made food banks an even more important resource for people struggling with food insecurity. Well, to dive deeper into this issue, WUFT's Eva Garcia spoke to Patrick Dodds, who's the executive director of Bread of the Mighty Food Bank in Gainesville. He says last year they were able to provide millions of meals, but this moment is different.
We're currently in a crisis. Even before the SNAP benefit delays over the weekend, we were seeing twice as many people in line at our partner pantries here through the food bank. And the problem is we just don't have enough food to meet the growing need. Now, with over 30,000 of our neighbors here in Alachua County seeing a delay in their SNAP benefits, we're going to see that situation worsen very quickly.
And what can the community do that might not necessarily need to come to the food bank or need SNAP benefits? What can they do to try to help with this problem?
Our biggest problem is we don't have enough food to get out to the community who needs it the most. So we're having to shift our focus to purchasing more and more food. So the best way you can help the food bank is to donate financially. It doesn't matter if it's just a few bucks. Every little bit counts. We've established an emergency purchase food distribution program in order to try and bridge this gap until federal benefits stabilize. So we're having to purchase more food than we have in a long time. The good thing about what we do is we're able to stretch the dollar as far as possible. Every dollar that's donated to the food bank, we can turn that into six meals for the community. That's upwards of 7 pounds of food.
And what concerns have you heard directly from individuals or families that might typically rely on SNAP that are coming in here instead?
The hard part about the delay in SNAP benefits is so many families are living paycheck to paycheck, and they are waiting for those SNAP benefits. They've already been struggling for the last few weeks at the end of the month in hopes that this assistance would kick in at the first of the month. Now that they don't have that, they're going to be facing really difficult decisions. The first of the month means rent's due. Their utilities are going to need to be paid soon. When you see a delay like this, even if it doesn't last longer than a week or two, a lot of people are going to make decisions that are going to plunge them deeper into a hole that was already looking difficult for them to get out of. And it's just going to layer on top of layers of debt and continue the cycle of poverty that has, you know, ultimately forced them to need the assistance of the food bank and other social services. So it causes a chain reaction, a delay in benefits like this. It's really unfortunate for a lot of people in our community.
And how does it feel for you personally to be at the forefront of a situation like this and helping with this kind of issue?
You know, I love this community. I'm raising my family in this community. I've lived here for over 15 years. I'm proud to be able to serve alongside the amazing people that work here at the food bank. I'm proud to be able to partner with as many amazing organizations as we do. But sometimes it can be very disheartening, right? You know, when we are seeing more and more people relying on the food bank for food, it can sometimes, you know, feel like a lost cause. But the reality is, this community is filled with a lot of very intelligent, innovative, and generous people. And so when we see so many people coming out to support the mission of the food bank to make sure that nobody in our community feels alone during this time, I think that really reaffirms the work that we do here. So I feel very fortunate that I get to be a part of this work every day.
That was Patrick Dodds, the executive director of Bread of the Mighty in Gainesville, speaking with WUFT's Eva Garcia about how the ongoing government shutdown is impacting food banks. With flight capacity expected to drop at major airports across the country due to the government shutdown, Floridians could see their flights affected. The Federal Aviation Administration announced yesterday they'll reduce flight capacity by 10% at 40 major airports. Both ABC News and CBS News have released lists of Florida airports that could be impacted, citing anonymous sources. They include Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood International, Orlando International, and Tampa International airports. Gainesville Regional Airport says it's still waiting to see how or if its flight schedule will change. They say their air traffic controllers are not affected by the shutdown, but those at connecting hubs could be. Thanksgiving and the days surrounding it are among the busiest times for air travel. Last year, the Sunday after Thanksgiving set a record with over 3 million passengers screened by the TSA, according to a Facebook post from the Department of Homeland Security. Travel experts warn that if you do plan to fly this holiday season, give yourself plenty of extra time to get through security checks, especially if the shutdown lasts through Thanksgiving. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News, exploring our community from top to bottom. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Do you have ideas for future episodes? We want to hear from you. Email us at therundown@wuft.org or tap the menu of the WUFT mobile app and tap Talk to Us. We may feature your voice on the show. But first, Florida has a lot of stories to tell. Do you know your community's history? It's time for a trivia question. In Dixie County, a sunken steamboat sits at the bottom of the Suwannee River and serves as a local archaeological site. What is the name of the boat? Stay tuned to the end of the show for the answer. On the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, an armistice agreement was signed to end fighting during the First World War. The war didn't officially end until 7 months later, but November 11th, 1918 would still go down in history. We now know it as Veterans Day, and it's coming up this Tuesday. WUFT's Maya Labby learned how different communities in North Central Florida are honoring their veterans this year.
From flag-placing ceremonies to car shows, Florida seems to have a little bit of everything when it comes to Veterans Day. Columbia County will host your traditional Veterans Day parade. The event is a joint effort by the American Legion and veterans of foreign wars. Kelly Vallier is the first vice commander of the American Legion post-57. Her organization supports veterans and provides resources within the community.
Columbia County has a actually very large veteran population, and we are just reaching out to our veterans in our community to inspire everyone to work together in Lake City and Columbia County to make life better for each other.
In Lake City, the parade starts at 11 a.m. on November 8th at the FDOT facility. Meanwhile, also this Saturday in Alachua County, Evergreen Cemetery will hold a flag-placing ceremony. Community members will help place flags on over 1,100 veteran graves. The project can take over 2 hours. That's according to Karen Pruss. She's the cemetery coordinator. She compared the event to a scavenger hunt, but said it's broken up into manageable pieces.
For me, I look at it as it is such an honor to be able to place a flag on the grave of every veteran. And even though they're deceased, we're still remembering that they spent the time and the energy to serve our country. So it's really important to remember our veterans and the sacrifices that they made.
Then over to Hernando County. The way they honor veterans is through something called VetFest. They're hoping to draw out families to the event with carnival-type games. Marianne Johnson is the president of Hernando County VetFest. She comes from a family of veterans, so according to Johnson, her work hits close to home.
I think they get overlooked. I've seen a lot of different veterans here and there that I've run across and spoken to at different things, whether it's out to dinner or, you know, I always, you know, reach out if I see somebody wearing a hat, you know, thanking them from their service. And some, you know, will actually, you know, open up and tell you, you know, gee, we gave so much and, you know, no one even recognizes us sometimes. So it's, to me, that's an important thing is recognizing when you see someone, no matter where you are, you know, to thank them for their service.
VetFest is in Spring Hill. It starts at 10 a.m. November 8th. But this next event is not this weekend. It's actually the following Sunday in Marion County. The Blue Star Mothers are holding their second annual car show. The event raises money for Marion County Veterans Park. Last year, the funds were used to build a monument. Debbie O'Rourke is an officer with the Ocala Blue Star Mothers Chapter Florida 10. She says she's learned a lot about how to pull off an event like this.
We had a member who had moved here from Texas, and her and her husband do car shows every single weekend. And we were talking about different ways to raise money. And she said, why not do a car show? Well, none of us knew anything about what a car show involved. And she said, oh, don't worry, I have someone that'll help us. So we're like all gung-ho. And then the person that was going to help us actually had a conflict that day, the other car show, the big one that I was talking about. So we kind of figured it out. We had some, like there's a group called On Top of the World Car Club, and some of their people talked to us on what we needed to do. And then I think we talked to some people from the Corvette Club. So we got some advice from, you know, other people that have done car shows. And we tried it and it worked. So we're excited. So we're doing it again.
The car show will be held at 11 a.m. on November 16th at Marion County Veterans Park. And so Veterans Day itself is coming up on Tuesday. For a lot of people, it's just a day off. But for veterans in North Central Florida, they're hoping it's simply a day that's never forgotten. Maya Labby, WUFT News.
If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Coming up on the show, we hear from two local authors who wrote a book about cultural sites in North Central Florida. That's after a short break. Stay with us.
Support for WUFT comes from the Law Office of Nellinger & Associates, a Gainesville law firm serving North Central Florida for over three decades, offering services in family law, business law, estate planning, and more. Information at lawyergainesville.com.
On the next Florida Roundup, we should know who will be the next governor of Florida in 1 year. Election Day 2026 is coming. On the next program, we'll speak with as many of the major party candidates for governor as we can. What will decide your vote? Is it about a political party, a personality, or policies? Let us know by emailing radio@thefloridaroundup.org, radio@thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Tom Hudson. Then join us Friday noon until 1 on WUFT.
This week on Science Friday, a scientist who dedicated her career to an understudied disease, endometriosis.
Oh my gosh, of course. I'm an engineer. There are things I could probably do that haven't been done before, so why don't we give it a try?
Plus, drama over invasive carp. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Fridays at 2 on WUFT.
Support from Sweetwater Branch Inn, a boutique property and event venue in historic Gainesville. Sweetwater offers a secluded getaway for medical recovery and business and personal travel. Located minutes from the UF campus. More information at sweetwaterinn.com.
Listen to Tell Me About It this Sunday morning at 7 for a discussion with the 44th Annual Downtown Gainesville Festival and Art Show on Saturday, November 15th and Sunday, November 16th. Lily Zoe, Downtown Festival and Art Show Coordinator, shares information on the juried artists competing for prizes, musical performances and street performers, children's activities, and how to experience the annual art festival and get the best experience. Tune in Sunday mornings at 7 a.m. on air, online, or on the WUFT media app.
Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. North Central Florida is home to so many amazing places. From natural wonders to local museums, the culture of our community is rich with history. So much so, in fact, that two women decided to write a book about it. It's called Cultural Sites of North Florida, a backroads guide to small museums and other local treasures. I spoke to the co-authors, Ronnie Loveler and Dixie Nielsen, about why they wanted to write this book and how it came to be. Here's Ronnie.
So I got interested in writing this book in part through the experience I had with Main Street Daily News. I started doing a series for Main Street called Florida Finds, where I would visit small museums or parks and write an article for them. And I thought, gee, this would be a great idea for a book, you know, to start expanding upon it and bring it into one collection. And then I thought, well, wouldn't this be a great partnership with Dixie? I have the journalism experience, but Dixie brings the whole museum experience to the package. So I thought this would be like a perfect partnership, you know, combining our resources, combining our knowledge in a way that I think has worked, actually.
I think it worked too, because Ronnie really brought a lot of things to the book that I may not have done, and that is introducing parks and other outside activities. So that really makes the book a lot richer. But my goal is, I'm on a soapbox because I like to champion small museums. I know that small museums get ignored. They don't get funding. They often have only volunteers who work for them. And they sit in their little museums with the culture of their entire area, their hometown or even the state. And they're places that really need to be recognized. And so that was my goal, was to bring that to the table.
So this book features cultural sites, museums, parks, natural sites across North Florida, from the Nature Coast to the First Coast and everywhere in between. How did you decide which sites to include, and what was your process for writing about them?
I think what we tried to do with a lot of it was find places that people might not know about, that they might just drive by. I'll give you my one example of a place that I must have driven by a million times before I went into it, and that's the Barberville Pioneer Settlement, which is right off of Highway 40 between Ocala and like Flagler Beach. And I used to go out that way a lot, but I never stopped because I couldn't see anything from the road. I thought, you know, who cares? But then one day I finally stopped, and it was amazing. It's such an interesting story about this community and this area. So I think that was the idea. Some of the things are known, but some of them aren't as known. And it's to highlight that and get people to know what's in their own backyard.
Some people who have looked at the table of contents said, well, why didn't you include this place or that place? We did have criteria for museums especially, and that they had to be small. And the American Association of State and Local History has a definition of a small museum. And that is, if you think you're small, you're small. But these are the places that don't apply for big loans or grants because they may not even have a full-time staff member.
And then if you had to pick a favorite site of all the ones you visited, which one would be your favorite?
That's very hard. I'm going to pick a favorite, though. But that's very hard, because if you ask me in 5 minutes, I'll come up with a different favorite.
But asking which is your favorite child.
Yeah. Well, I can choose my favorite grandchild.
Yes.
Because I only have one.
I have 8 grandchildren, so I have a harder time picking.
But I would say the St. Augustine Lighthouse Museum is one of my favorites.
I have several favorites. One of them is here in Gainesville, and that is Theater of Memory. The gentleman who owns it, Bill Hutchinson, has traveled around the world, and he's personally picked every object in there. And it's exquisite to see the way each room in that building tells a different story.
That was Dixie Nielsen and Ronnie Loveler talking about their new book, Cultural Sites of North Florida. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. As a reminder, our trivia question this week: in Dixie County, a sunken steamboat sits at the bottom of the Suwannee River and serves as a local archaeological site. What is the name of the boat? The answer's coming up at the end of the show, so stay with us. Before that, though, a quick break, and then pumpkin spice. Why are consumers still so obsessed with it over 20 years later? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
On the next Planet Money, why would some immigrants in the U.S. send more money home during an immigration crackdown?
We have had a growth of 26%, which is not typical.
And on How I Built This, 2 early-stage founders get business advice from host Guy Raz and Nurid Shah, co-founder and CEO of Wayfair. That's on the next Planet Money and How I Built This from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 on WUFT. Last week on Wait, Wait, Josh Gondelman reacted to the news that our pets are suffering from boredom.
Yeah. To see a bored fish. Because you're like, wow, you think they have it all. They live in a castle, and still they're as depressed as the rest of us.
And Peter Sagal, if your goldfish is bored, have them listen to this week's news quiz with special guest food pioneer Roy Choi. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Saturday morning at 11 on WUFT 89.1, 90.1. NPR News and Talk.
When Corey sat down next to me in first period chemistry class, my heart fluttered. I'll never forget his first words to me. Yo.
Join us for True Stories, all about advice. Next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at noon on WUFT 89.1, 90.1.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois on the immigration raids taking place throughout Chicago and well beyond.
He's creating mayhem on the ground because you know what he wants? He wants troops on the ground in American cities. And the only way he can get that done is by proving that there's some sort of insurrection taking place on the streets of Chicago.
J.B. Pritzker, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Saturday afternoon at 1 on WUFT, 89.1, 90.1.
Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Well, fall is here, and you know what that means. Pumpkin spice is back. From coffee to candles to cookies, the flavor seems impossible to escape. But how did pumpkin spice become a cultural obsession? WUFT's Crystal Felix looked into it, and she sat down with a University of Florida marketing expert, Carlos Lopez, to find out.
I think that it's because it's tied so closely to the turning of the leaves, so to speak, it just becomes habit forming. And Starbucks especially has continued to carry it and promote it heavily. I was looking at the store traffic for Starbucks since they launched the 2025 campaign for the pumpkin spice latte, and you see a 27% jump nationally for their stores on that Tuesday compared to all the other Tuesdays across the year.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. I've never taken a look at the data. I feel like for a lot of people, it's kind of like that bandwagon effect. Like everyone thinks that's the trend and they want to be part of that too.
Absolutely. And I think that it's not always seen positively, but it's really become a meme and a kind of a part of the cultural. It's become a cultural phenomenon where pumpkin spice just organically pop up in social media, in TV shows. It's become this very popular thing that people talk about and associate fall with.
Exactly. So how do you think companies have managed to turn pumpkin spice into more than a flavor, like a cultural symbol? I know we've been talking about that, but how do you think they use marketing to really execute that?
They've tied a lot of their menu into the limited time offer kind of cycle, but tied to a season because it's so much easier to do that instead of just putting an arbitrary time. So you see companies that have really jumped on the bandwagon, and it's been good for some companies, and for some products it maybe isn't a perfect marriage and maybe a sign of like oversaturation of the market.
Yeah, could you explain what that oversaturation of the market really means?
So when market becomes oversaturated, it's basically, it's gotten so big, but because so many people companies have jumped up board and have offered it, and going back to what made it popular in the first place was that it was a flavor that no one was really offering. So if you get to a point where everyone is offering some sort of pumpkin spice product, especially ones that don't represent the flavor or scent or pumpkin spice anything very well, then it loses that feeling of special. And initially, you might see a sales boost by being associated with the brand, but as more products come in and dilute the brand, then it brings the sales down for everyone involved.
That was Carlos Lopez talking about why and how pumpkin spice became such a huge phenomenon. The Rundown is a production of WUFT News. Our trivia question this week: in Dixie County, a sunken steamboat sits at the bottom of the Suwannee River and serves as a local archaeological site. What is the name of the boat? The answer? The boat is named the City of Hawkinsville. That's it for The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. The news is next.